Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS-LP in Columbus, Ohio. Past episodes a week after airing of this show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for commentary or whatever at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This episode will be re-airing an interview with Christian Williams, the author of Our Enemies in Blue, which is an abolitionist history of policing in the United States from an anarchist perspective. It was recorded in August of 2011, so some of the historical elements of it can be fiddled out by listening to it. We'll hear that right after this Sean Swain segment.
I'm nuts. Totally bonkers. I just found out last month, and quite frankly, I was relieved. Up until the mental health people brought my file for my review and I saw the diagnosis, I thought everything I was seeing in the world was really happening. And I mistakenly thought I had a good grasp of what it all meant. Turns out, I'm just a Fruit Loop. I can sleep much better now. It's not the world that's gone mad, it's just me. I'm as mad as an 18th century glue sniffer in a hat factory. The mental health professionals of the Ohio Department of Retribution and Corruption said so. So, I can stop worrying about the state of our world and the evil designs of the privileged few, the reign of terror we all face under a global tech surveillance police state. I can better spend my time skipping naked around my cell, or sculpting busts of dead presidents out of piles of my own harvested boogers. In fact, that's what's probably expected of me. As a total whack job, I've been quite a disappointment. But in my defense, I didn't know I was Looney Tunes. When I got locked away in 1991, the head shrinkers of the prison system subjected me to several batteries of tests, gleaning everything they could about my mind and its workings. I remember some of the tests were quite fun. You had to rate yourself, most like me or least like me, and read the statements. I remember one of them was, I like manly women, and there was a bunch of strange ones that related to how I felt about my mom. Most psych tests are veritable giggle fests. At any rate, in 1991, the shrinks found I was perfectly normal. They entered no diagnosis into my file. That same diagnosis remained in my file year after year, even through 2005, when Toledo Warden Calicante had me hidden at the prison system's nut house for a month after his staff assaulted me. The shrinks recognized I had physical wounds, but there was nothing wrong with my mind. So given this long-involved pattern of mental health professionals confirming my sanity, you can see how I could make the mistake of trusting my own sense of things and believing the world to be as I perceive it, right? Turns out, nobody realized I was ziggity-boo until at least 2012, right after I wrote that article explaining how prisons director Gary C. Moore is a sock puppet for corporate profits.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded or monitored.
After his counsel, Trevor Clark, put the fix in on the 12-monkey frame-up. And at their weekly naked twister game at the office, they brainstormed every possible way to ensure I die in prison. Then, suddenly, and under no influence from Gestapo Gary or train wreck Trevor, the grand poobah of the prison shrink department decided I have antisocial personality disorder. So, right after the torture wonks who run the prison system decided they hate me, I went, overnight, from completely normal to absolutely wiggy-wiggy, with no bathroom breaks in between. Pretty amazing, huh? And just so you know, antisocial personality disorder is not as bad as it sounds. It's worse. Let me read a bit of the diagnostic definition so you get a sense of what behaviors characterize this disorder. Here goes. There is a pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others occurring since age 15 years, as indicated by failure to conform to lawful behaviors, deception, repeatedly lying, conning others, impulsivity, irritability, aggressiveness, failure to sustain consistent work, lack of remorse, being indifferent, rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another. Yeah, I'm bat-ish crazy. Probably can't say bat-ish, it'll come out bat-ish. I'm bat-ish crazy. So, as I hope you can understand, once I found out how I really was, given this diagnosis, I didn't even feel safe being locked in the same room with me. parole board won't feel safe either. And to think, I've been like this since age 15 and fooled everyone, including myself. At least according to the diagnosis. So I'm not sure what the Department of Retribution and Corruption discovered about my behavior at age 15 when I was 43, but it must have been serious. But the bigger question is, how much crazier does this prison system have to make me before I'm no longer a danger to the public and get released? After all, they have billions of dollars in several decades to do the important work of driving 50,000 other prisoners bat-ish crazy. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm sculpting Richard Nixon. This is Ohio Governor in Exile-elect Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878, Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. This interview was originally aired in August of 2011. Christian is the author most recently of American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination, available from South End Press. His first book, Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, was initially published in 2004 and has been re-released by South End. His work on policing and torture has also appeared in Counterpunch, New Politics, In These Times, and in the collection Confrontations, available through Tarantula Publishing. In addition to researching state violence, Williams also frequently writes about comics and cartooning. He's a regular contributor to the Comics Journal, and he's discussed comics in some surprising places, including the LA Daily Journal and the Columbia Journalism Review. He's presently at work on a book about Oscar Wilde and anarchism. Thanks so much for being on the air, Christian.
Oh, well, thanks for asking me.
Your book covers the history of policing in the United States with a starting point marked as developing out of slave patrols rather than the more service-oriented model of the London Watch. Can you elaborate on what this says about the nature of policing and how it's developed in the United States in terms of class and race?
I guess I should note at the beginning that the history that I put forward is sort of heretical account. And if you go to the community college where you live and take a criminal justice course, on the first day of the criminal justice course, they're probably going to say something about, like, you know, where the police come from, and it is not going to be that story. They're going to tell you a story about the night watch, which we inherited from England, which took hold in Boston, and in response to a crime wave became the modern police. And I go into this in much more detail in the book, but I find a more credible and more, I think, more systematized account is running that attached to slavery, there was this militia organization called the Slave Patrols, which in response to periodic crises, fears of slave revolts, over time, the Slave Patrol went from being a unprofessional, sporadic, I don't want to say volunteer because it was more like you got drafted into it, but, you know, not for pay, not regular shifts, not that kind of organization, and became a professionalized, regular, broader law enforcement organization. And that happened in stages over the course of 100 or so years, resulting in what I think is the first, at least the first thing I've seen that's identifiable as looking like our modern police force arising in Charleston, South Carolina, right at the end of the 18th century, right at the beginning of the 19th century. What this says about the police is that from their very inception, they were there to control, on the one hand, the black population, and on the other hand, the labor force. And it happened that in South Carolina, these were the same bunch of people. But it developed with specifically that race and class character in mind. This wasn't incidental to how we got this modern institution. It was the point. And I argue in the book that if you look at how the institution has developed since then, and if you look at, for that matter, how the police use their discretion on the street, or for that matter, even at the level of policy, that really the race and stratification of the community are still the main driving factors in determining what the police do. And that's in some ways pretty remarkable, and on the other hand, makes what they do intelligible in a way that if you think about what they do as having something to do with, like, fighting crime or punishing bad guys or something like that, like, a lot of what they do just makes no sense at all. But if we look at it through these two lenses of race and class, their priorities, their activity, the decisions they make suddenly come into focus. That said, I don't know how different it would have been if they had developed out of the English model and out of the Night Watch. I think we would probably have an institution that looks very different. But given the history of colonialism and given the stratification of our society and also the society that they were borrowing from, I'm not sure how different it would have been. And, you know, the fact that there are half a dozen cities in England on fire right now because of the police killing people maybe points to some of the similarities.
So, yeah, so London, Birmingham, Liverpool, and other major cities around England, like you said, are in their fourth day of rioting in response to the murder of a black man, Mark Duggan, by Metro Police. Darkest Howe, a journalist and commentator from Brixton, has called the unrest an, quote, insurrection of the masses, unquote. January of 2009 saw nights of burning and looting around San Francisco Bay Area in response to the videotaped police murder of Oscar Grant. For almost a month prior to that, parts of Athens and other cities around Greece and Europe burned in response to the police killing of Alexis Grigoropoulos. The banlieues of Paris revolted in 2005 after a young black kid was killed while evading the police. And there's, of course, the videotape beating of Rodney King with the city of Los Angeles rising in rebellion following the verdict or lack of verdict against the police. There are tons more incidents that are like those, individuals maimed or killed by law enforcement in popular rage, rising into a riot or a rebellion. Do you see these responses, like we're seeing in England and like we've seen in other parts of the world, as a heightening awareness of the role of police in society by the most downtrodden and affected? Or has this just always been there and technology is just allowing word to travel faster?
I think there have been riots in response to policing for as long as there has been policing. You know, in sort of the generation before the wave of riots that you just mentioned, and I'll mostly just talk about the U.S. here because that's what I know about, but there were riots in Los Angeles, Detroit, Philadelphia, Boston, San Francisco, in the East Bay, and, you know, this goes back before the period that we tend to think of as, like, the militant 60s. I mean, the Detroit riot was in, I think, 1963. Before that, there was one in Newark, which I think was in 60 or 61. And all of those were set off by either by some sort of police action. Like, usually it was killing somebody. It didn't have to be exactly that. And, you know, you'll look back at the 30s, and in 1934, there was an earlier Detroit riot, also set off by police action. And similar things in the teens, going really all the way back to the early 19th century. And I think it's just rioting has been the tactic of last resort for the sort of lowest stratum of the population. And that's been true for, you know, since before there were cops. It just happened that the police have a interestingly prominent role in the cycle of unrest, in that, you know, for one thing, they're the first body that's responsible for responding to it and putting it down. And often, their action in response to it, whatever the initial cause, becomes the target of the rioting. So the things that the cops do often make the rioting more intense rather than actually quelling it. And the cops themselves become targets as kind of the embodiment of the coercive power of the state. And then it's also that the police representing the power of the state as they walk around and do their business, and that business involving harassing, bullying, brutalizing, sometimes killing people, it's not surprising that they become the trigger that sets off this whole conflagration. Coming out of the period of rioting in the 60s, there were several government commissions set up to study them and basically to figure out what to do differently to stop that from happening again. But the most famous of these was the Kerner Commission. And they described the initial incident that sets it off as being typically something that the cops do, but that the context in which it occurs makes that incident seem representative of the entire system of inequality, and that the what's important is that the police have acted in some way that seems to perfectly capture the power dynamics of the society, and that that then ignites what the commission referred to as the reservoir of grievance of the black community. And so, you know, the cops have a very visible role in the unrest cycle, but it ties into concerns about housing, concerns about education, concerns about employment, poverty, and, you know, the general humiliation of racism. And I think that's been obviously true in the English example, where, you know, people are really worried about unemployment and also the imposition of austerity. Now, one place where I think the technology may play a role is that, you know, it used to be that the incident would happen and somebody would see it and then they would tell somebody else, and the word about it spread, you know, literally by word of mouth. Now, it may be on video, and the symbolism of, you know, for example, the police killing Oscar Grant or the cops beating Rodney King can be visually communicated and is, I think, more compelling than it may have been previously, and therefore can also, like, spread faster. So I think there's more of a chance for what may have previously been just another incident of the cops killing somebody to become the trigger for that kind of unrest. But the unrest itself is really nothing new.
So in your article, The Other Side of the Coin, you present your research into discussion and sharing of training and information between law enforcement and military occupational forces of the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan. Can you talk about that? Why did you call it The Other Side of the Coin?
Yeah, this is an article that I wrote for the journal Interface, which is available online. If you go to my website, which is christianwilliams.com, and you look at the tag that says articles online, you'll be able to find it there. But I called it The Other Side of the Coin, to some degree I'm being punny, because coin is military jargon for counterinsurgency. And there are really at least three reasons that I called it that. One being that we tend to think about counterinsurgency being something that happens, you know, overseas, that it's done, you know, at the frontiers of the empire. And I'm suggesting that the other side of that is that it infects the interior of the empire as well. Secondly, we tend to think of counterinsurgency as being typified by the, you know, the hard tactics, the drone attacks, the death squads, concentration camps, you know, that sort of business. And one of the things that I argue, I hope forcefully, in the essay is that it's also the legitimacy building, sort of nonprofit NGO work, and the co-optation and the public relations aspect, and in terms of policing, the community policing project, that is also part of the counterinsurgency dynamic. And then the third reason is because wars have two sides, and, you know, it's pretty clear domestically the one side is the police, and they're pretty clear on who the other side is. But we need to, like, the problem is that opposition movements in the U.S. mostly don't think of themselves as being involved with war against the state, and we need to catch up, or the state is going to just keep winning it.
More from our conversation with Christian Williams about his book, Our Enemies in Blue, and a conversation from August of 2011 after this musical break.
I have heard some people make some very degrading comments about the cops recently, and I personally believe that people should refrain from making degrading comments about the cops, because the cops have a very difficult job, and they do it very well with great pride and integrity, and therefore I wrote a song in support of the cops, and it goes like this. Come and gather round, you people, now, and listen to me yak. All you doctors and you lawyers and you folks who push the crack, and all you folks who push the buttons and you folks who push the mops, come listen while I tell you how I really like the cops. Oh, I really like the cops. I think they're pretty cool. I like them in my neighborhood. I like them in my school. I think the cops are wonderful. I think the cops are nice. And I like to have a broken jaw and carry a pack of ice. I really like the cops. I think they're pretty neat. I like it when they take my face and smash it on the street, and then they drag me to a station and they lock me in a room, and then I like it when they rape a with the broom. I really like the cops. They make me want to sing. You know, my favorite movie is that tape of Rodney King, and so I really get pissed off whenever somebody like you suggests we should subject the cops to citizens' review. I really like the cops. I am so glad that they're around to hassle me and ticket me for sitting on the ground. I really love the cops. I'd be so sad if they were gone. There's something about a uniform that always turns me on. Yeah, I really like the cops so much, folks, that I don't think you should find out the number of your local cop watch group. And if there is no cop watch group in your town, that's good. I don't think you should start one. And if you're walking down the street and you see somebody getting hassled by the cops, I don't think you should stop and see what happens. I think you should just walk on by, because that person must deserve everything they get for not looking rich enough for the cops to leave them alone. And if you're with a group of people and the cops start picking on...
Christian, can you talk a little bit about community policing, what the term means... And its applications. It's referenced a number of times in The Other Side of the Coin, that interface article that you wrote. It's referenced by the Rand Corporation. It's referenced to a degree, I believe, by the field manuals that you quote in it. How did that develop, and what are the implications of community policing?
Yeah, I'd be glad to talk about that. There's a lot of confusion about community policing in sort of the liberal left. And to some degree, that's because the state has done its job well. But a lot of people, you know, well-meaning, in my view, naive people, think that the community policing is really the thing that we want to be going for, and that, you know, it means that the police will be part of the community and that they'll, like, understand our, you know, our norms and our culture, and that they will not be this, like, alienated, occupying force, but will be there to, like, genuinely respond to problems that people in neighborhoods have and that sort of thing. And that is definitely the image that the cops want to develop. As it happens, that is not the real agenda. And in Our Enemies in Blue, I make this argument that the two main developments in policing since the crisis of the 60s, those being community policing and militarization, are actually two halves of a single development, which is the reinvention of the police on a counterinsurgency model. And some of that is that if you look back at the police literature from the period where these changes were taking place, from the 1970s and the early 80s, what you very quickly see is that both of these were driven by the police concern over the unrest of the 60s and trying to find ways to head off similar unrest in the years to come. And one of the things that they learned about that was that the 60s left them sort of suffering a loss of legitimacy. Like, the cops had really been discredited. They had very low sort of social esteem, not a lot of community trust. And one of the things that they had learned was that they needed the cooperation of the public if they were going to do their jobs. And so community policing was born out of that insight as a way to gain the cooperation of the public so that they could control social unrest. And, you know, as it happened, there also community policing and militarization, you know, they didn't just arise at the same time in response to the same social situations. They also tended to arise in the same places. So the places that were experimenting with the Neighborhood Watch and the DARE program and community meetings and all that sort of thing were the same police forces that were introducing SWAT teams and getting helicopters and doing and reorganizing their command structure to be more military-like. And so, you know, the evidence pushed me in that direction. I was previously familiar with some of the counterinsurgency literature, and I understood the counterinsurgency relied both on having access to overwhelming force and also doing things to build legitimacy for the counterinsurgency force, meaning, you know, gain popular support, learn to interact with the population in the occupied country, and that sort of thing. And so the parallel to me seemed very stark. That's the way the evidence led me, so that's what I argued in Our Remains in Blue, and I was really unsure about it at the time. Like, I kind of thought, like, that I may just be a crackpot. Well, it turns out, you fast forward a few years, the U.S. invades and then occupies Iraq. General Petraeus, who had written the new U.S. Army Field Manual on Counterinsurgency, gets put in charge of the occupation force. Suddenly there's this huge explosion of literature on counterinsurgency, much of it directed toward giving professional advice to the U.S. Army in Iraq. And it turns out that a lot of that literature points to the domestic police in the United States and their community policing programs as an example of counterinsurgency and how it should be done. You know, on the one hand, I really don't relish being proved right about this, but on the other hand, I'm very relieved in terms of, like, what it says about my analytic skills.
So you're not as big of a crackpot.
Yeah, it turns out I'm not a crackpot. Or at least I'm right, even when I'm a crackpot. So the point of community policing is to insinuate the police into the community for the sake of increasing their power over the community, and specifically for the sake of neutralizing any possible opposition that may come out of that community.
And in a way, that sort of thing can be seen in governmental takeover of presentation of services that came after the Panther Party, for instance, developed the breakfast programs and the medical clinics where that was lacking, right? The government's able to insinuate itself in there and then slowly, after they've taken over the program, sort of defund it.
Right.
And take away any teeth.
And, I mean, you know, the government taking it over in some ways depoliticizes it, right? That means that they take away the thing that the left had to offer, right? It also means that they control it. They can put in their agenda. And it means that once the threat has abated, you know, the threat in that case being organized black people with guns, once that's abated, then they can phase out the services that they were providing. I mean, something similar actually happened with the women's movement and the development of battered women's shelters, which, you know, at the time, that was totally this grassroots, very feminist, very politicized effort, which over the course of 40 years now, the state has largely co-opted and has used that to tie the protection of women from men who have been violent to policing, in effect, to other men who are violent. And, you know, that's the incite statement that I was mentioning before was to some degree responding to that trajectory and the insinuation of the coercive force of the state into what at one point was this radical political program.
And sort of the major theme of Insight's book, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, right?
Yeah. Is that, you know, that is one of the ways the repression happens. It doesn't just happen by them kicking in your door. It also happens by them sort of channeling, using incentives, including access, legitimacy, funding, to channel your political action into areas that are safe for the government, that, you know, where the challenge is to some degree neutralized.
I was wondering if you could speak on the efficacy or purpose of civilian review boards. I know a lot of cities have organized around police accountability and helped to bring these in, and to varying degrees, police departments have been, you know, helpful in the process or fought against it. But what can you say about your experience with police review boards?
Well, everywhere that I have looked into it, the police have fought it being established until such a point that it became obvious that they were going to lose that fight, at which point they totally got on board for the sake of getting the kind of review board that they wanted. So they typically lose the fight to for there not to be a review board, and then win the fight of what kind of review board they want. The result being that review boards tend to be relatively powerless, relatively ineffective. Most places they don't really, you know, most places they can recommend, they can issue a finding, or they can recommend discipline against an officer, but they can't actually discipline him. Most places they can recommend policy changes, but they can't actually set policy. So the result tends to be that important community figures or prominent activists who would otherwise be, you know, in the neighborhoods organizing people or on the streets, you know, causing trouble with the cops, instead are stuck in some boardroom in City Hall hearing the, you know, seemingly endless testimony about this or that particular incident with the cops for the sake of making some recommendation that will either be taken or ignored. If the point is to waste the time of people who might otherwise be leaders in opposition to the police, civilian review boards do a great job. If the point is to actually hold the police accountable, not so good. And some of that is the details of how the things are set up, and specifically what the laws say, and specifically what the policies are, and all that kind of like boring bureaucratic crap. So some of it is that the civilian review board is the wrong tool to address the problem that we have. And the problem with the police, you know, the reason that we have trouble with the police is not usually that the cops are breaking their own rules, or that they're, you know, they're liars, or that they're individually prejudiced, or any of that. Although all those things are sometimes true, right? The reason we have a problem with the police is because we have a society that's stratified very sharply in terms of race and class, and that the job of the cops is to preserve that stratification. And there's not a review board in the world that can do anything about that. That said, if you're in a city that doesn't have a review board, organizing to demand a review board can provide a very good avenue to bringing out a lot of the dirty laundry that the cops have and giving people an opportunity to articulate what their complaints are and giving, and to some degree, building momentum to stake out other positions in sort of a politics against policing. So, you know, I don't want to just say that it's never worth pursuing, and to some degree they probably do put some check on the most egregious abuses, but don't expect too much out of a civilian review board.
More from our conversation with Christian Williams about his book Our Enemies in Blue in a conversation from August of 2011 after this musical break. At the Law and Disorder Conference that happened earlier this year at Portland State University, you gave a presentation on the distinctions between the goals of police accountability organizing and police abolition organizing. Can you elaborate on that presentation?
The distinction that I was drawing out was that police accountability organizing suggests that there is some sort of role for the police, and that the what's needed to address the problems of the institution involve some reforms either within the institution or some sort of external checks and balances, but that the organization is, you know, that the police organization is necessary and to some degree legitimate and in principle salvageable. The abolitionist perspective, on the other hand, suggests that the institution policing itself is so tied to the inequalities of the society that it operates in, especially those based on race and class, that in the process of eliminating those inequalities, we are also going to need to get rid of this institution of policing and find some other means for ensuring public safety and resolving disputes and handling social conflict, that sort of thing. So in the short term, the way this tends to play out is that police accountability activists pursue reforms in the form of better policies or, you know, different training, or the sort of ultimate stage in this is the establishing of a civilian review board. Hope that with sort of the correct internal and external mechanisms that policing can be done in a humane and fair way. And in the short term, there's a real question as to what the abolitionists should be doing, because though the ultimate aim is to, you know, totally change the structure of society and get rid of the coercive institutions that we now have, that's not exactly something that you can plan for next Tuesday. You know, it's more of a remote goal. And the question of what you do to work toward that is a fairly complicated one. And so the advice that I was giving in the course of that talk was that this isn't just a matter of, you know, do you pursue reforms or do you pursue revolution, that actually abolitionists need to engage in reform work, but they need to engage in reform work very carefully and only engage in those reforms that actually do limit the worst abuses and tend to weaken the institution as a whole and reduce police power and shift power toward the community, and not get sucked into working on reforms that are going to strengthen the institution or improve its functioning or prolong its life.
So in line of alternatives to police, and that being an increasing debate, I saw on the website for Rose City Cop Watch that members of that organization, which you volunteer with, have been doing presentations on alternatives to policing, what's wrong with policing, the whole rotten barrel idea, and what community restorative justice models might look like and what they've looked like in different places around the world. And you sort of touched on this during the last chapter of Our Enemies in Blue, but it seems like there's an upswing in discussion around the Pacific Northwest and in Portland in particular, between Rose City Cop Watch and I'm sure other projects, and the community alternatives to policing. Just seen a couple of their pamphlets on the alternatives to policing. How much of that discussion has been the generalized population and the populations that are most affected, like people of color and mostly poor people?
That's a really good question, and it's probably hard for me to say anything about that definitively. My impression is that, especially if we take a sort of slightly longer view, like look at this over the course of, like, compare where we are now to where we were 10 or 15 years ago, my impression is that over that amount of time, this discussion has become more publicly articulated, and that's moving from both. And on the one hand, you know, there were plenty of radicals, especially anarchists, who, when I started this work in the mid-90s, you know, thought that we needed to get rid of the police and did not have a very precise idea of what that would mean. And that's part of why I, in the last chapter of Our Enemies in Blue, I described a couple of places where policing, because of social conflict, policing just became impossible in the normal sense. And social movements, in particular, I talk about the movement against apartheid in South Africa and the Community Restorative Justice Project in Northern Ireland. But the social movements took on the question of how to address crime. And, you know, I sketched that out to some degree just to show that people had done something else, and that whatever the problems were, it presented the possibilities, right? The fact that people have done something else implies that we can do something else. And at the time, there was really very little in the sort of social movement literature about that. Right? It was, know, the people who looked at those particular conflicts knew a little bit about it, but there was, you know, if there weren't stories about alternatives to police and experiments in restorative justice just sort of circulating in the activist milieu overall. Now that in the 10 years since then, that's clearly changed. Similarly, I think in the communities where the police are most present and most abusive, and in particular, those are poor communities and among people of color, you know, it's not news to them that the cops are a problem. And it's not like a new idea for them that if there's something else you can do instead, that you should probably do that instead of calling the police. And so, there have been some very informal, some more formal sort of organic responses to crime and interpersonal conflict and all that sort of thing in those communities, I think always. They haven't generally been formal or permanent arrangements. They haven't usually been attached to more of a political project. That said, one thing that I've seen very recently in Portland is that discussion has taken a more sort of systematic bent and has also to some degree entered into the mainstream discourse more. The best example of that I know of is there's a newspaper here in Portland called The Scanner, which I believe is the largest black newspaper in the state. And it ran an editorial a little more than a year ago after this very tragic incident in which this African-American family called the police because they were worried that this young man, Aaron Campbell, was distraught and was considering suicide. So Campbell wasn't a criminal suspect, and he wasn't a danger to anybody other than himself. And the police showed up with the SWAT team and ordered him out of his apartment, and as he was attempting to comply with their orders, one of the snipers on the SWAT team shot him and killed him. And The Scanner ran an editorial saying very upfront that it's not safe for black people to call the police, and that, you know, everyone can see why the Campbell family would do that. Everybody could understand the pressure that they were under, but that in the scope of things, the black community needed to find a different way of making sure members of that community are safe, because the police cannot be trusted to do it. Now, you know, I doubt that was much of a surprise to the readership of that newspaper, I mean the sort of target audience, but it was in the newspaper, and it was something that then other newspapers picked up on, and to some degree the editorial became itself a matter of controversy, and there were, you know, there was a lot of talk in the media about the fact that this point had been made in print. Again, I don't think it was a new point to the black population, but I think that it's showing up in print to change the conversation in the larger, more mainstream media.
More from our conversation with Christian Williams about his book, Our Enemies in Blue, and a conversation from August of 2011 after this musical break.
What we gonna do about the man in blue? What we gonna do? What we gonna do about the man in blue?
Go!
Can you speak a little bit to how the dialogue, or the difference, I guess, between abolitionism and accountability has become more clear among organizers around policing issues in the Pacific Northwest? I mean, over the last year, I've at least found references to, in Portland, there being marches, you know, a number of marches last year in direct response to killings by police. In Seattle in April of last year, actually in Olympia, April of last year, August of last year in Seattle after John T. Williams was killed, throughout the first half of February, in March and in July after a house party was raided by police and people were beaten and hospitalized. Is this a new, sort of a new period in organizing against the police, where people are like, is the idea of abolitionism becoming more prominent, or is it just the people who have abolitionist, often politically radical or anarchist people, just becoming more vocal and maybe like drawing from Greece and drawing from other examples where police brutality has led to, or from LA, you know, in 92 or any of these other examples? Right. Do you feel like it's changing, or just are people becoming more vocal?
I think there's some of both. And I think that the two tendencies build on each other, but they have some different causes. On the one hand, you know, when, again, looking back 10 or 15 years ago, there were definitely people who we would now call police abolitionists. And they were doing, you know, various kinds of anti-cop organizing, but they were to some degree inside and obscured by the police accountability movement, and there was not a distinctly abolitionist position either within or separate from the police accountability work. Right, so there were people who individually thought that we needed to get rid of the cops, but lacking other avenues for doing that, became involved in accountability work. That's largely reflective of my own experience in any case. I think one of the things that changed that, and also one of the things that really put the need to find alternatives on the sort of left-wing activist radar, was the creation of Critical Resistance, which is a prison abolition organization, in, I think, 98. And they really staked out this bold position about getting rid of the prison industrial complex, top to bottom. And there were a lot of really smart organizers involved in that. There were a lot of really credible intellectuals involved in that. And I think they really, like, they staked out that position, and they did it in a way that was credible and legitimate seeming, and the people took seriously. And I think that opened up space within the area of people who are mostly concerned about police to do some of the same thing and to stake out a police abolition position and to build on some of that work. The interesting, with Critical Resistance also put out a statement within Sight arguing that...
Which is Women of Color Against Violence, right?
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Arguing that, on the one hand, people who are working in violence against women need to take the violence of the criminal justice system seriously and do something about that. And on the other hand, people who are fighting the criminal justice system need to start creating alternatives in order to address violence within communities. And I think that really served to motivate a lot of people to do some serious thinking about those questions. At the same time, I think that some of what we're seeing is that there's been an increase in specifically anarchist organizing and sort of anarchist political activity, especially in the Northwest. And some of that, I think, is building off of the, maybe not even so much the occurrence of the WTO protests in Seattle, but the memory of the WTO protests in Seattle. And so one of the things that helped develop was a distinctly anarchist area of political action, to some degree autonomous from the rest of the left. And I think one of the places that anarchists distinguish themselves, to some degree, I think, mistakenly from the rest of the left is sort of claiming a monopoly on the police abolitionist or prison abolitionist point of view. And so when the there's already an uptick in controversy around the police, it makes sense that that will build on this sort of anarchist, developing anarchist milieu, and we'll see an increase in activity in that area as well. And so, some of it is, I think, specific to the issue of policing, and some of it, I think, is a more general increase in anarchist activity.
Within the left, what other groupings are not necessarily taking an anti-police perspective, as in police upholding this system that we live under and that leftists are going to agree is a horrible system, but actually proposing alternatives and direct resistance of those institutions? What tendencies are there?
You mean besides anarchism?
Yeah.
Well, the two places that I have seen that coming from that I have already mentioned, one being the position represented by critical resistance, which, you know, I'm sure that there are anarchists involved in critical resistance, but many of the sort of luminaries of that organization and many of the people who were involved in the founding of it are definitely not anarchists, right? And one of the people who is most cited in terms of talking about prison abolition is Angela Davis,
yeah,
who, you know, was a longtime member of the Communist Party and is definitely not an anarchist. And the other being the kind of feminism that is represented by Insight and their work on ending violence against women and children, and them taking seriously the fact that the state is also a perpetrator of that kind of violence. Again, I'm sure that there are anarchists who are involved with Insight as well, but it is not...
They're not explicitly anarchist organizations,
yeah,
or
exactly,
organizing models.
And if you look at sort of the rhetoric and the culture and the theory of an organization like Insight, and you look at the rhetoric and the culture and the theory of the sort of like the kind of anarchist milieu that, you know, tends to actions, they're obviously very different. There are probably other places on the left as well that are putting forward ideas about that just either I don't know about or aren't coming to mind right off the top of my head.
Well, Bring the Ruckus for a while was organizing around like forming cop watches and Black Cross type organizations like prisoner support groups around the country, right? And that was a lot of Trotskyists as well as anarchists and radical left folks.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes. And actually I'm a little bit embarrassed that didn't occur to me sooner. But BTR has been doing work around that. To some degree here, for a large degree in the Bay Area. And their position is a little bit hard to sort of nail down, but it's they're definitely some sort of like libertarian left cadre organization, which is distinct from the sort of anarchist milieu that I was describing a minute ago, and also very different than the sort of critical resistance perspective that I was talking about before.
And Christian, could you speak briefly about another recent article you've written called Profiles and Provocateurs about the FBI infiltrating radical communities, in particular anarchist communities?
Yeah, let's see. This is an article that I posted on a handful of internet sites and, got reposted other places. And I was moved to write it because I read an article in The Stranger, which is the alternative weekly in Seattle, about this. In particular, I'm looking at not just snitches, but provocateurs, meaning people who, in the service to some government agency, don't just tell them about crimes that are happening, but actually create criminal activity for the sake of setting people up. And in particular, I was looking at when this is done targeting anarchists. And there was an article in The Stranger about this guy who got involved in this like after hours party scene with the idea that he was going to like insinuate himself into this cultural niche and from there be able to find people who were involved in the Earth Liberation Front. And in the course of that, he totally failed at that mission, but he did manage to set a bunch of people up for illegal gambling charges, and he managed to set one guy up on a drug bust. But reading the article, the thing that struck me was that he exhibited any number of behaviors that, whether or not he was a cop, people really just shouldn't have been putting up with. And at the same time, there were any number of just sketchy-seeming details that the people that he set up had commented on, but that nobody had bothered to follow up on. Like, at one point, somebody went to his apartment, and they went to the bathroom, and there was just nothing in the bathroom. Like, no soap, no towels, like, no toothbrush.
He's just Spartan.
Which is pretty odd. So anyway, this got me thinking about some of the other cases that I'd heard about, in particular the Brandon Darby case, where he helped set up a couple of much younger activists on firebomb charges related to the Republican National Convention in 2008. And the woman who's only known as Anna, who helped set up Eric and David and a couple other people on a, like, basically Anna on the FBI's behalf while being, like, while on their payroll, created a ELF-style cell and created a plan to blow up a dam and then brought in the FBI to put her co-conspirators in prison. And so in the course of the article, I try to point out some of the commonalities that these people exhibited. And the main one is that they preyed upon people who were felt like they had something to prove, and they basically bullied them into doing things which really I think most people looking at it from the outside would have to say that whatever your politics are were just bad ideas.
So, Christian, what's coming up?
Well, I have a couple pieces that I've been working on this summer that should be out in the next month or so. One of them is a piece for In These Times about a couple of the police killings here in Portland that have happened in the last several years. And I don't want to give away too much here, but the argument that I make is that we can see some of the class and race dynamics play themselves out in these cases, and that what they reflect are efforts for the police to exclude people that are considered undesirable, in particular poor people and people of color, from some of the commercial areas, and that they're doing that in direct response to the agenda of the Portland Chamber of Commerce, which is called the Portland Business Alliance. So that will be in These Times. I think it comes out the first week of September. Also, coming out right around Labor Day, Dollars and Cents will be running an article that I wrote about the labor unrest in Wisconsin earlier this year and the cops' role in both supporting and repressing the unions there. And I compare that to other historical cases in which the cops have slipped out of their usual repressive function and have in some way or another aided the struggle of workers. That's what I have on the agenda for the next few weeks.
So we've been speaking with Christian Williams, author and activist out of Portland, Oregon. Thank you so much, Christian, for taking the time to speak.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on. Anytime.
You've been listening to an interview that we conducted with Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue, A History of Policing in the United States from an Abolitionist Perspective. From back in August of 2011, more archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org.